I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and this is Radio versus the Martians.
It's funny, I was culling my collection, which isn't that huge. It's basically one large bookshelf. But I decided I was going to reorder things, not just alphabetically, but by publisher.
Mm.
I was going to take all the Marvel and DC stuff, and I was going to put it on its shelf by itself, and then everything else will be in another area. And when I pulled all the Marvel and DC stuff out, it was like half of one shelf.
Oh, wow.
And then everything else was this entire other bookcase.
That is crazy.
And I had not realized that it was that way. Because, of course, a lot of people on Reddit do post pictures of their bookshelves, and it's almost exclusively Marvel and DC stuff. And I always shake my head.
It's like walking into a Barnes & Noble. You have the same thought as you can see from half a store away. You can see the spines of the Marvel and DC comics trades. You know,
right.
There's so many of them.
They've marketed it well in a way that you can, especially Marvel. Marvel's trade dressing that they've always done, I think, has always been smart. And I think this goes across the board. Just Marvel as a company has always been infinitely better at marketing themselves than DC.
Even going back to the 80s when spinner racks in comic book or in supermarkets were a thing. And they would put the little box in the top left corner for the trade dress that tells you what comic that is, even if you can't see the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they used to have that Marvel Comics Group bar at the top. Just the way that they did it, even back in the day, that they would use the name Marvel all the time. Marvel was a brand name.
Stan Lee was an amazing hype man.
God, he was. I mean, He's a fun writer, and he had little fun turns of phrase and stuff. I think that he gets overhyped as the creator guy, but as a marketing guy, he is a fucking genius. Nobody, I don't think, has ever come close to being the cheerleader for their company that he was for Marvel Comics. That there really is nobody that compares.
Him and Vince McMahon.
Vince McMahon. Yeah.
In terms of being the face of their organization and putting themselves out as a character.
Yeah.
Because believe you me, Stan Lee is a character.
He is.
He is a character that Daniel Leibowitz has been playing for 50 years.
Oh, God. And just getting the name Marvel on anything, even before Marvel was its own production studio making movies, one of the things they did, this is, again, getting to the fact that they are just amazing at branding, is that all those Marvel movies that were being licensed out to all these other companies had that red production logo at the beginning. Whether it was Sony with Spider-Man, whether it was the Hulk movie from Ang Lee, from Universal.
Well, even going back to Blade.
Yeah, Blade. I mean, you get that logo so that everyone saw a connected brand tissue, even though these movies are all being made by all these companies. So by the time you made Iron Man, that red logo was like, everyone knew what that meant. And that's something DC has never had. I mean, their superheroes are more recognizable than anyone save maybe Spider-Man. And then in terms of how old were you when you first realized that Spider-Man was a character? Really young. But I bet you were even younger when you realized who Superman and Batman were.
It would have been pretty close in there. I really can't say, because I mean, I grew up in a very geeky household having two science fiction writers for parents.
Oh, well, there you go.
I did not know that, Tobias.
Yes,
that's
both
great.
My parents are science fiction writers. And in fact, I love to tell this story. My mom first got into comics in college in the late 1960s because there was somebody on her hall, in her dormitory, who would just attach comic books to a piece of string and hang them on their dorm door. And she would go and sit in the hallway and read these comics. And in fact, I love to razz her about this because in 1960...
That's bird stealing.
In 1968, she wrote a very irate letter to Marvel, which they published.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Because the Avengers were fighting the Hulk, or maybe it was the Fantastic Four were fighting the Hulk, but the Hulk runs east in Manhattan, and jumps into the Hudson River. And as every good New Yorker will tell you, the Hudson River is to the west of Manhattan. The East River is to the east of Manhattan. And she was like, your offices are in New York. How do you not know this?
Yeah.
And they basically gave her like the perfect like editor, like, okay, you're taking this way too seriously. Kiss off.
That's which pretty
is,
awesome.
Is lovely.
Do you know what issue that was published in?
I want to say that was the letter I think was published in Avengers number 14.
Oh, wow.
And the issue in question was an issue of Fantastic Four. And she never knew that this letter had been published because she was reading a different book. But I actually managed to find a picture of it online and send it to her.
Oh, that's great.
She took very gracefully.
Oh, wow.
But I could go and look it up, but I think it was something like Avengers number 14.
That's awesome.
There's an old comic. I know George R. R. Martin has a couple published letters written in Marvel Comics at the time, too.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, one of my favorite things that they've put out, I don't know if you've ever picked up any of the big Marvel omnibus volumes.
Occasionally, yeah.
They look like you could be used as a weapon in the game Clue. Those things, some of them are definitely worth picking up. I have the first three volumes of the Uncanny X-Men ones that go from the 1970s with a new team through the early 80s.
Those are the ones they republished in black and white, correct?
Yeah. Those are the essential ones. These are
okay,
the ones,
the essentials, yeah.
These are the ones that are big hardcover. They're,
okay, I know
get them
you're
cheaper than
about.
They are off of a website that I go to, but for about half price, but they would normally go for like $100 a piece. I get them for like $50 a piece.
Right.
I'm not bragging about that. I'm just trying to.
What's your secret, Mike?
Well, it's not that. It's more of like I want to explain because everyone knows how expensive this is, and I don't want to seem like I'm a junkie.
Well, what we're not telling you is that DC Comics just paid us half price in for your graphic novels for us pumping their Flintstone trades.
Oh.
We're getting kickbacks.
Payola,
baby.
I haven't wanted to broadcast this. But I talked to a comic creator at a con once and somehow got on his email list for like previews of his books that are coming out. So, you know, like the month or a couple of weeks before a new trade comes out, I will get a digital copy of it in my email address for review purposes. And even though we're not like really reviewing books so much these days, I've never been like, yeah, stop sending me those free comics.
But yeah, the omnibus, they actually do one thing that none of the other trades do, which is they include the old letter columns.
Oh, that's excellent.
Wow.
And
but not the ads, I take it.
No, not the ads are gone, yeah. But the letter columns still exist because that's published by that. I don't think they still want to sell any copies of Grit now. So, but in the letter columns, one of the things in those new Team X-Men books. This is like in the 1970s, the X-Men went from being the five teenagers from the 60s to a reprint title and then got revamped in the 70s, where nowadays they would have just been canceled. But the X-Men got a whole new team because I guess Marvel was full of SJWs, so they replaced it with a culturally diverse group of people rather than just the four American teenagers. So this is the team that gave you like Storm and Nightcrawler and Wolverine and Colossus and all the people that you actually know as X-Men. So you got to see in a time capsule form, those people that were reading Marvel Comics thought of the new team. The real breakout character is Nightcrawler. Everyone loves Nightcrawler. Storm is probably number two. But the thing that I think is the most hilarious reading this is that people fucking hated Wolverine. They hated him so much. They're like, get him out of this comic book. I hate that he's always fighting with Cyclops. He is such a jerk. Get rid of him now. And I look at this from the perspective of I live in the year 2018. And there are like a dozen X-Men movies that have come out with a big budget to a mass audience. And the central character of almost all of them is Wolverine. That he is one of the most... The joke with Wolverine, with a lot of comic book fans, is how overexposed he is. Because he's in everything. But when he was new, people hated him. They hated this character that has probably made them billions of dollars. And
one of the great luminaries of our time famously said... haters gonna hate.
Yeah, it's just true. But it's weird, the fact that you could win people over time. That
People hate new things. They hate different things. They think they do. They think that they want more of the same thing that they've always gotten. And one of the worst excesses of the comic book community or the industry is that those people have been catered to far more than they ever deserved. I mean, my God, if you polled Flintstones fans and said, what do you want out of a Flintstones comic book? You would never in a million years get the Flintstones comic book that we got.
Yeah, well, this is the case for you don't want continuing franchise things to be written by hardcore fans, right?
No.
There's a danger there. But you said something that was like, you said something, well, maybe in the 70s there was a band of hardcore SJWs writing that. I have to get this has been bouncing around in my head for months now. There's a member of my family, I will not, we won't have to expose here who it is, who was upset at the casting of Rogue One. They didn't have any particular problem with the fact that the story was incredibly weak and the characters were underwritten and nothing they did made any sense, because, as they put it, the people who produced the Star Wars movie do not want white men to be good guys anymore. And I often do not have a great comeback. Probably Mike is probably the guy I know who has the best.
I'd probably say
comeback.
Maybe it's so white guys don't want to be good guys anymore. Right.
But it's that people don't want only white guys to be heroes.
Sure, yeah.
So, but this is the only thing that I can think of now after turning around for weeks in my head is when someone makes this kind of a statement about a decision based on a huge franchise, and this extends to comic books and stuff. When somebody makes a statement of saying, well, the reason why they chose to do, you know, to put a woman of color in the lead there is because obviously they don't want white, you know, they don't want white guys to be in there. And the only thing I can keep think of now is, so you being just this one person, you can adequately explain this multi-billion-dollar franchise that has to play across the world to a couple billion people, and you have all the answers. It conforms immediately to your prejudices about the world and not to the financial decisions made by committees upon committees upon committees of a multi-billion-dollar multinational corporation.
But the weird thing, too, is they, in a weird way, inadvertently explain why representation is important without realizing it, which is they say, it's important for me to see myself on the screen. And they don't realize they're saying that. It was like, well, why is it that you think that you can represent everybody, but somehow if somebody doesn't look like you, is that stopping you from being able to relate to that main character? Why is that? And I think that when people throw out, you know, pejoratives like SJWs are taking over my comics, I think what they're uncomfortable with is that they see themselves in the villains, and it makes them really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
That when the Marvel brings back the Sons of the Serpent, which were an anti-immigration group, not just an anti-immigration group, they were based on like the fucking Klan, and they were created in the 1960s, and they have always talked like that, Fox and Friends. This isn't a new thing where they're trying to make them sound like that. They've always been racist, they've always been anti-immigrant, and by the way, they were the fucking bad guys in that story, and the Avengers beat the shit out of them for it. That's nothing new, and I think a lot of times it blows my mind. I'm like, well, fans of genre fiction who are also enjoying things like Star Trek and all of this stuff that has always dealt with social issues, what is it that's not reaching your brain? What is it that it's not being communicated that you don't see that this stuff has always been political, it's always been social? And I think on some level it's because it's old. And because they feel like, oh, well, that stuff's been settled. But when that was made, it was just as controversial.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been like that. You're just finding that you are the caveman now. That the bad guy is saying something that you might say, and you don't like seeing that portrayed as the bad guy. And I think maybe that if you see the bad guy talking like you, maybe you need to have a long conversation with yourself. And maybe have a little bit of introspective of like, oh, I wonder why that supervillain says things about immigrants that I do. Maybe there's something wrong with me. You know, maybe, you know, I don't want to say the sort of things that are said by people that Captain America punches. Maybe I don't.
That's a good heuristic for you to live your whole life.
That's an ironclad. That is an ironclad law. If you are on the opposite side of an issue from Captain America, you're wrong.
Yeah. And the idea that Captain America is only now political, it's like, you haven't read any Captain America comics then. I mean, how many times has Captain America quit being Captain America because he's disillusioned with the way the world works? At least three times.
I was going to say three.
Yeah, at least.
At least.
At least three times. And one of them was after a storyline where it turned out that the president, who in silhouette is clearly fucking Richard Nixon, was leader of a secret evil organization called the Secret Empire. And when Cap and Falcon cornered him in the Oval Office, he shot himself in the head. And Cap was so disillusioned by that that he went off and became Nomad for a while. And then he quit being Captain America in the 80s so that a right-wing, more compliant with government policy Captain America could take his job. And, I mean, this has always happened. This has never not happened. This is the only thing that is done with this character. It's literally the only thing.
It's pretty much one of the three classic Captain America stories, which is, you know, it's something happens with the Cosmic Cube, or Captain America gets mind-controlled and turned into a bad guy, or he quits because people are trying to pressure him into doing something he doesn't want to do.
Exactly. This is Captain America. And who does he primarily fight? Costumed versions of hate groups. Constantly. He's always fighting that.
You know, and that's something that occurs to me that the Marvel movies have not embraced.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with the last iteration of a not an Avengers movie, but the Captain America movie was, well, you know, team up fights between various Avengers, right?
But it was him quitting at the end from being Captain America.
True. That is true. Obviously, S.H.I.E.L.D. did turn into a super secret Nazi organization undercover.
And I just really hope that when we get to Black Panther, and of course that'll be in the past by the time this comes out, they have done with Captain America what they did with him in the comics, which is... So Steve Rogers, before he became Captain America, was an artist. That's what he used to do for a job before he was a superhero back in, you know, the 1930s. And so when he was trying to set up a secret identity for himself, he went to get an art job at a company in New York, Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Because Marvel Comics canonically exists in the Marvel Universe, and they license the rights to the Fantastic Four and publish comic books based on their real adventures. And so there was a period of time where Captain America was employed by Marvel Comics as an artist drawing Captain America comics.
This is true. That would be great.
And my God, do I hope that they have the balls to insert that into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because it would be incredible. I would love it.
See, I think they have done a lot of political stuff with Captain America. Winter Soldier, the thing I love the best about Winter Soldier is, of course, there is a revelation that the evil Doomsday device that can kill any person from space was concocted by the secret, you know, Hydra Nazi guys who have been controlling the government since World War II. But Captain America was against the Doomsday weapon when he thought Nick Fury was in charge of it.
Yeah.
That's why I love Captain America. Yeah. It doesn't need a guy with a monocle whose face is a computer screen controlling it. That's not when that became a bad idea. It became a bad idea when anybody had that power. And I love that about Cap. He's like we've said this before, he is the anti-Jack Bauer.
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy who should represent what America should be, not necessarily what it is. And like kind of what he does in that movie with both Nick Fury and Black Widow, who are much more cynical characters, who are kind of very much, you have to do ugly things to get things done. You see him kind of break through their cynicism, and they're won over by his example.
Absolutely. Captain America has always been the idealized image of what America could be or what it wants to see itself as, and he is always the first one to stand up and criticize the America that actually is. He believes in the equality of all people, and when he sees people being mistreated or enslaved or taken advantage of, he's the first one to go, no, that's wrong. It's wrong when other people do it. It's wrong when we do it.
Yeah, I love that. So when somebody screams about SJWs in comics and stuff like that, when they look at Captain America, what Captain America comics were they fans of in the first place that they're upset now, because I don't understand.
They weren't ever reading them. That has to be the answer.
No, but some of these people, they clearly have been doing this for a long time, but something is not, there's a missed connection here. It's like you put that in the paper, missed connection, the point of this comic book, me, reader.
It's like, I don't know. I mean, that misconception has been there for a very long time. You can see it in Frank Miller.
Especially
his Daredevil work, where Captain America would occasionally show up and it'd be like, wow, what Captain America is this who's basically filleting himself with a flag?
Yeah, you don't give Captain America to Frank Miller.
You really don't.
Frank Miller, and he's such a mixed bag, because some of his stuff is truly great comics that he's created. He has created some truly amazing things, and he's also created some things that mean that he should probably have a long, dark talk with himself.
Frank Miller is the poster child of the meme of too big for an editor.
Yeah.
Frank Miller needs somebody to put their boot on his throat and hold him down and say, Frank, you cannot do this. This is too much. And I'm one of those people that believe that Frank Miller has had some kind of a brain cancer or something that has radically affected his thinking in recent years. And, you know, as somebody who has family members who have dealt with mental health issues, I only wish him the best. But there is a certain point where you can see first him getting too big for an editor and being allowed to do things on his own that he should not have been allowed to do with those characters. Batman, Holy Terror.
Jesus Christ.
And then at a certain point, like, you can see his mind starting to go away and him just being off in Looney Tunes land.
He kind of turned into this literal interpretation of like a comment thread at some point.
Yep.
No, that's something you don't want to see personified.
No, Jesus. It's not good. It's definitely not good when I look at that. And it's sad, because he has done some truly great things. And this is the same thing with Dave Sim. Dave Sim is another person who has been kind of, he's allowed his work and his life to be hijacked by toxic ideas. And those toxic ideas have personified who he is and who he presents to the world in such a way that he doesn't get to have the place in comics history that he does deserve. But it has this huge asterisk next to it, and that asterisk is bigger than his accomplishments. That he used to be the patron saint of self-publishing. That he did a book called Cerebus that started out as kind of a parody of Conan with a talking aardvark. And his whole goal was, I'm going to self-publish this. I will own it. I will control it. It'll run 300 issues, and then I will have my character die in the last issue. That was always his goal. And that he would use the back pages of his book to give attention to short works by up-and-coming creators that he liked and who were trying to create their own self-published works. Like Jeff Smith's, a lot of his first work was published in the back of Cerebus. What is his name? Terry Moore, who did Strangers in Paradise. Some of the first stuff he got published was the pages that were lent to him by Dave Sim in Cerebus. That he would go out of his way. I knew people who had done their own comics and talked to them privately, and they have very conflicted feelings about Dave Sim, because on one hand, this is the person who went out of their way to help them more than anyone else, and this is the guy spewing this weird kind of, like, toxic, you know.
You've heard about the contract.
No.
Oh my God, the Dave Sim contract that he makes you sign before he will talk to you, where you declare that you do not believe that he is a misogynist.
Yeah. You're not going to have any good interviews out of that.
No.
And right off the bat, I'm like,
from what I understand, this isn't even an interview contract. This is just to speak with him on the phone.
Oh, yeah. See, Dave Sim had a moment, and I don't know what it was. I think it might have worked in conjunction with an ugly divorce. I don't know what it was, but he decided at some point that he'd start putting essays in the back of his comic, and that his essays were like this weird metaphysical misogyny. It's like the idea that men are this creative light and women are a soul-sucking void.
It's weird, because there's this certain brand of writer that get what in my circles we like to call the brain eater. And usually it's, you know, they've gotten a little bit older. Maybe their wife has passed away, or, you know, somebody who is a moderating influence on them, where they've decided that they are like they are the light in the way, and then they will speak truth. And, you know, from their the fountainhead of their mind, they will create wisdom that the masses will listen to. And they just go off to crazy town.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it seems to happen, especially with this certain breed of kind of like, you know, they start off as like maybe slightly conservative and then over time become more conservative and more conservative and then just go off to Looney Tunes town where, you know, they're, I mean, what happened to Robert Heinlein, for example, where, you know, he would, all the stuff in his later works where you've got Lazarus Long, who's having sex with his mother and in a polygamous marriage and, you know, all the stuff in Stranger in a Strange Land. And it just, it gets very, very weird. And this is something that you see over and over with writers of this stripe where they just become more extreme and more extreme over time.
Well, I think I forget what it was. There was a commentator on CNN back in the day. I forget what his name was, but he made some remark about immigration at some point. And it was right of center and not something I'd agree with, but moderate compared to a lot of the stuff you see today. Mm-hmm. And I think what happened was that you got a reaction from it. And that there are going to be people who are your viewers that are your readers or your listeners that like it and people who dislike it. And the people who get angry at you go, oh my God, I can't believe you said that. And then you also get people who are concerned. Like, I don't think you've thought this through. Here are some things, and this is how what you said affects me personally. And then you have the fans of that thing. And oftentimes the fans of that thing are more extreme than the person who said the thing. And there's a human inclination I think we have, and it can be really dangerous if you don't have a strong enough sense of self in this, that you find yourself gravitating more and more towards the safety net that catches you when you screw up. Hmm. And that you start identifying more, and the things you say start becoming more extreme and more extreme. And I forget what the guy's name was, his commentator, but he went from being sort of the centrist CNN commentator to basically being Rush Limbaugh within the course of like 3 years. And I think that can happen to somebody. I think there were a lot of toxic people that were fans of Dave Sim that got, you know, people were calling him names. And these are the people that had his back. And he started identifying more and more with them. And I think that we have a tendency to do that, that the people that catch us are often the people that end up shaping our ideas because we're in that vulnerable place. And people have attacked our pride. And we don't want to say that we were wrong. We don't want to think about what we said in a critical way, and we just kind of get down that rabbit hole. And I think Dave Sim sort of went there. The fact that he is forcing people to fill out those contract things, which is ridiculous because that thing was blatantly misogynistic, you know.
Did either of you see the documentary, the R. Crumb documentary that was in the early 2000s?
I did not.
Did you see it?
No.
So when R. Crumb was a teenager, or maybe he was even before he was a teenager, and his brother was older, they both loved Long John Silver. After reading the book and seeing the movie, and the first comic books he ever made with his brother were he would draw the characters. They would draw out their own panels, and his brother would do the dialogue. That would be was the division of labor. His brother started to. I think his brother became a schizophrenic because this starts to happen to some people when they're teenagers. Over time, you could visually see the transition from someone who is more or less trying to write a character as it stands to be the character talking for themselves, and then over time the characters got smaller and the dialogue bubbles got larger, and then at the end, each panel itself was just words, and there was just a small dot. It was words that were increasingly illegible because they were drawn so small and the characters were so out of whack, and the characters either didn't exist or were tiny. And that's the kind of thing that I think about, is that it's got to be some kind of mental illness that you start moving towards this space where you want to write these long screeds, and the point gets lost, and the work that was supposed to back it up is shrunk and overshadowed by what that is. And that's clearly like the Frank Miller case, is at a certain point in time, his screeds became the thing, and it completely overshadowed the rest of his work, so much so that you can't see the characters anymore. There's no characters anymore. It's just the screed, you know?
I think our mutual friend Joe Preddy had said something about this. When you go back and you reread Frank Miller's classic stuff, you the stuff that sticks in your long-term memory is often the problematic stuff, the stuff that hasn't aged particularly well, the tropey stuff, the kind of dark, angry, quasi-fascist-y sort of stuff. And that's the stuff that you got to remember. So you walk away from Frank Miller going, oh, God, and you just remember that. Then you go back and read it, and all that stuff is still true, but it's also this masterful storytelling that's revolutionary and amazing, and it's cinematic, and it's exciting. And you realize this guy is really fucking good at making comics. But then you walk away, and again, what ends up sticking with you is all the worst parts of All-Star Batman and Robin.
Right, and you can see those same elements in their infancy.
Yeah.
And you go back and you read the early Daredevil stuff, and then you look at All-Star Batman and Robin and things like that, and it's like, I can see the through line. I can see where this thing became more prominent and more extreme until it just completely came to dominate the work as an entirety.
Yeah, where you look at All-Star Batman and Robin, Casey, you haven't read it, have you?
No.
It's like a beautifully illustrated cry for help.
Jesus.
Frank Miller hadn't written Batman at this point for a long time. I think he was coming back to the character. He hadn't done him for probably over a decade at this point. And people remembered that this is the guy who did Dark Knight Returns. He did Batman Year One. His Batman work is actually pretty brief, but it was really instrumental in how people see the character. That every time you see Batman's parents get killed and his mother's pearls fall to the ground, that's Frank Miller.
Oh.
That you're so sick of seeing her pearls after a while. But the pearls are all Frank Miller. That was his that was the most lasting thing he added to that character, was the scene of his parents being killed and how it's portrayed.
And I think certain elements of the way that Batman is narrated.
Yeah, the way he kind of monologues, and, you know, every time you see parodies of it now, where it's just like, you know, I look down and blah, blah, blah. And it's like what Rorschach is kind of the absurd, crazy person version of.
Right.
And with Frank Miller, though, you look at, say, All-Star Batman and Robin, and it's like the crazy bits have overtaken everything, where Batman kidnaps Robin from the circus where his parents are killed, spends like 3 issues driving him around in a car, threatening him and slapping him. And I think there's a line is like, what are you, retarded? I'm the goddamn Batman. Which, if I was going to start a petition, it would be to change the name of that comic to The Goddamn Batman, because it would let people know what they're in for.
There's apparently a fan theory that that's not Batman in that comic book at all. It is a deranged hobo named Crazy Steve,
yeah,
who found a Batman costume and put it on and has convinced everybody that he's Batman.
So he takes a kidnapped Robin back to the Batcave, and the idea is to lock him in this room until he's forced to eat rats because he's so hungry. And Alfred, being a human being, goes, okay, that's crazy. I'm going to give him a cheeseburger. And Alfred is also, there's some weird stuff with Alfred where it's kind of like Beefcake romantic novel cover Alfred, where he's like shirtless and he's got the big movie kiss. And there's a lot of weird stuff. Wonder Woman is what people on internet comment threads think a feminist is, where there's a scene with her walking down the street and she knocks a man over. She says, out of my way, sperm bank. And
Jesus.
I mean, it's sort of needlessly dumb and mean-spirited. Superman is just like this nebbish weakling who is really strong, but he's like, I don't know if I want to do anything. It's weird. It feels like a crazy person wrote this. And there have been a lot of theories about whether this is bad on purpose. Is Frank Miller saying something about his perception to fans and he's making a parody of it? Is he actually having a breakdown on the page? Is he reacting to the high level of expectations that he's up against coming back to this character? So he said, fuck it, I'm going to have fun. I don't know.
Nobody knows.
I don't know.
It's a mystery to everyone.
Frank Miller, I feel so bad about whatever it was that happened to you. And I want to know that I'd gladly give, you know, some money to any charity that wants to help correct this problem and make you feel better. Because I'd like you to come back and make comics again.
I'm telling you, man. Brain tumor.
I wonder.
It's gotta be. Like, you see pictures of him and he goes from looking like a, you know, fairly robust, pretty reasonably looking person in his mid-50s to within like 2 years looking like he is in his upper 80s, and he looks like a decrepit skeleton.
He kind of
does. Like something bad happened to him medically.
It's like Rorschach with that kidnapping case in the 70s.
Broke him, right?
It's like something happened. He saw something, and now he's digging through people's trash and screaming about the liberals. And you're like, what happened to you, sir? I don't know what happened. I'm not equipped to help you, but somebody should.
Well, I guess, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about Frank Miller, who has clearly written, he's contributed to the art form of American comic books immeasurably. However, the thing that, I mean, we just got finished doing an hour talking about something about Flintstones with a writer that I think probably hardly any of our listeners had probably read before we recommended it. Like, we should at least be cautious enough to let the listenership know, which I didn't really fully understand, I think, until I met Mike, which is that the entire spectrum of the medium that is comic books encompasses far more than superheroes, and far more than even the super than just this circle of superhero names that are we all know through pop culture sort of osmosis. And there are so many other writers that are worth reading. There are so many other voices that are there. And the crazy thing is that we still because of his association with the greatness of those characters, and especially Batman and Daredevil, I guess, we still talk about him, and there's so many better voices that are happening right
now. Well, yeah, especially right now. Yeah. I think that, I mean, Mark Russell is great, and he came out of seemingly nowhere. The thing that got him started is an illustrated book called God is Disappointed in You, and it's essentially him taking the Bible and writing it in plain language and saying, I don't want to approach this with any ideology to either tear it down or build it up. I just want to say what's in there. And he just kind of put it in plain language. It's called God is Disappointed with You. He made a sequel to it, which is about all the other books that didn't make it into the Bible. It's called Apocrypha Now, which is one of my favorite puns. And that was the book that got him Prez, the reboot that he did. Prez is a great title. Prez came out during a mini reboot that DC did.
DCU.
Y-O-U. Which was fairly maligned by a lot of fans
What is DC? What was that supposed to be?
It was like a radical break from
the same moment that they introduced the new Batgirl with her new costume. And it was kind of them, I think, trying to steal some of Marvel's thunder from titles like Ms. Marvel.
Mm-hmm. The idea of having new, younger voices from outside of traditional comics. So I think webcomic folks came into it, doing things that didn't necessarily look like a standard DC Comics title, and bringing back a lot of things that unfortunately don't pull a lot of water in terms of their IP value to them. Prez was a comic book that lasted like 5-something issues.
6, I think.
Yeah, in the 1970s.
In the 70s.
Yeah, the original one. It was actually, the original Prez is shorter than the new Prez. It got canceled early.
I have never read it.
I've never read the original Prez. All I know is that it was about a teenager guy who had kind of a 70s haircut and a turtleneck that had the presidential crest on the front of it. Because he was elected president as a teenager, and it was, you know, DC being hip and young, and it didn't last because people really didn't want it. But it was something that people write. It's like Brother Power the Geek, which is a weird, strange thing that was created and canceled too early, but people keep repeating it because it's kind of weird that it existed. And so they rebooted it, and they gave it to Mark Russell because somebody had read God is Disappointed in You. And they went, it's a great book. It's a great book that nobody bought. And it, like Flintstones, it was originally intended to be a 12-issue series and have an end, but it was canceled after the first 6. They were going to do, I think 2016, they were going to do an election year special and then bring back the last 6 issues. That got canceled. It exists in a world where it's massively critically acclaimed, but nobody bought it because it doesn't star Batman. And the new version of it, the girl who becomes president is somebody who had a viral video on YouTube, essentially, whatever the equivalent of that is. And the idea of doing a world that is a dystopia that has the outward appearance of being a utopia because of all the conveniences and weird things you have, but people still don't have fucking healthcare. And how somebody can be thrust into the position of being president and actually try to change things and be meaningful in a world that is incredibly superficial and only cares about ratings and only cares about the stupidest of distraction, you know, bread and circuses type entertainment.
I don't know what that's like at all.
No. See, so clearly the...
so alien to me. Like, how could I appreciate that story?
Mark Russell clearly brings a point of view to his books and says, I want to actually take a thing that I don't care about. He openly said, when he got the phone call from Dan DiDio, of all people, who recruited him to do Flintstones, and he says, like, I don't care about the Flintstones. I don't want to write the Flintstones. And they said, well, do whatever you want with it. And they said...
which are some of the most dangerous words in the English language when it comes to writers.
And he takes advantage of that more than any other writer I've seen in the modern era. And he's such a laid-back dude. You'd imagine he'd be like, no, I got to tell you all about blah, 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 blah. He'd be like the economics professor in that Flintstones issue who's constantly popping in because he has another thing he needs to tell you. But he's such a laid-back dude who's just like, yeah, there's a lot of things wrong with our culture right now. And we don't really want to think about a lot of this stuff. And that's what a lot of his books are about. And they're amazing. And the Exit Stage Left, the Snagglepuss Chronicles, which is his new one, looks incredible. I haven't read it because I'm a trade waiter. I guess DC probably thinks I'm the devil for that.
A trade waiter? Is that real terminology or is that a micism?
I am 100% a trade waiter as well.
Yeah, then this you're saying
I'm killing the comics industry.
Yeah, I hate that they say that shit, by the way.
Oh, it's 100%
bullshit. Do they make that claim that if you don't purchase the single issues, then you're making...
you get canceled? Even though those crossover hits that they're so desperate to have are the ones that will sell in trade, but not month to month. Because it's not going to be the fucking Wednesday Warrior that are going to pick up your book. The people who show up as lifers are not the ones that pick up Prez. They're not the ones that pick up, like, you know, Devil Dinosaur and Moon Girl. They're not the ones that pick up, you know, Squirrel Girl. Those are not the things that are going to sell in high issues the same way that Vertigo wasn't. You have to realize there's a different audience than that. And there was a... getting into another rant here, there was an interview I heard recently with Heidi McDonald, who writes The Beat, the comics website. And she used a phrase that has really stuck with me from this interview she did on Off Panel, a comic book podcast you should all listen to. She called it the twilight of the pamphlet. That it's not doomsday, but it's like there's a recognition that the comics as a medium is growing. And she compared it to the way people look at climate change, that the world is different and we have to make strong, systemic, serious changes to how we do it. Or some of these companies like Marvel or DC are going to be left behind. That they seem married to this idea that this is a magazine format. And that the very people that they can win over who would love their stuff are just not going to walk into a comic store to get it. And buy it as a monthly issue.
There's a webcomics guy. I want to say his name is David Walker. Although I could have that last name wrong. But he did a series of comics talking about the comics industry in the last few years. And one of the very first things that he talks about is the Teen Titans cartoon that was so popular a few years ago had an average audience of something like 2 million people on each episode for its first broadcast. And the current Teen Titans book that was going at that time sold, I think, about 20,000 issues a month.
That's insane.
And it's 100% insane. And how do you have 2 million 8 to 12 year olds watching this cartoon every week and not be able to sell a comic book to them?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah.
You have to be incredibly actively bad at your job to have as bad numbers as the comic book industry has.
And even those numbers, you don't really know what that actually means in terms of readers, because when they release those top 300 lists of comic book sales, those aren't books that left shops in people's hands that people pumped down $3 to $4 for. That was the number that was sold to the retailers. That those are the order numbers. That when you see that there are 100,000 copies of Batman that sell, which is the only book that usually hits that number of digits on a reliable basis, that's the numbers that were sold to comic book stores. Those are not the numbers of books that had readers. Some of those books are sitting in back issue bins right now and gathering dust. And the minute that trade comes out, the odds of that one issue selling go down even further. So there's a real weird notion of understanding how many people buy that. And then you get into the way that if they're kept alive by these retailers, these specialty retailers who are often living hand to mouth, day to day trying to sell these comics to people. And the comic book industry really takes advantage of them on a major basis. Like, a variant covers is, I really think, are the fucking devil.
Oh, absolutely. That, well, they're a sign of the sickness of the industry.
They're a way to prop up their numbers in an artificial way. The way this usually works is that they say, okay, for how many thousand copies that you buy of this issue of Action Comics, we will include a variant cover of that that has a different cover that you can probably sell to one of your hardcore fans in your show, in your shop, for probably about $20 to $50, because someone will massively overpay it because it has a slightly different cover with a different artist on it. And they will say, but to get that one that you know you can sell to that one guy for $50, you have to buy all of this stock that you know that you can't sell. So, and what that ends up doing is all that stock you don't sell still goes into that sales number for that month because it was sold to their real customer, which is the retailer, not the reader.
Sure.
And you end up just filling this full of this crap that these people cannot move. So it makes me wonder, how long can we sustain that?
Yeah, well, just consider the fact that 10 years ago, one of the biggest movie properties in the world was Harry Potter. And at the same time, bookstores were moving millions upon millions of copies of Harry Potter novels. Today, the largest, by far, movie properties that come out every single year are superhero movies. They make billions of dollars each. And yet, we're struggling to put superhero comic books in the hands of readers.
I mean, from being the outsider perspective, from the not lifer, and I've probably even said this before, there isn't a understandable intimidation factor behind even walking into a comic book store. Often, if you don't look like us, you probably have a harder time fitting in at a comic book store. Although that's not always
necessarily
true. Some
of them look like dungeons too. Yes. Some of them are a lot right. scarier than others.
But I will say, being from someone who's not a lifer, the intimidation of not being able to actually step in to a story that's 800 issues into a continuing story and to be able to grasp what's going on is probably one of the things that, for someone who's positive and open, like I am, about being like, oh yeah, it's a story I'd read, that's the one thing that would just defeat it for me. It's to be like, well, there's no beginning to this story. There's only, I'm viewing General Hospital on its, on its 752nd episode, and I don't know what the fuck's going on.
And even aside from that, when they do have big stories, it's like, well, you can't just read Amazing Spider-Man.
Right.
You have to read The Amazing Spider-Man and The Spectacular Spider-Man and Venom and all of these other comic books that we're including in this, that there's no easy way for a customer, especially when that customer is a child or a teenager, to go, Mom, Dad, I want this book. And for them to go and get that book and get something comparable to what they expect, having seen the cartoons, having seen the films, that the comic book industry is actively hostile to new readers.
But they're also, so you were talking about the apparent epithet of being a trade waiter. For someone to wait for
they blame books, you for cancellations
books to be released in a much easier and more digestible format. Like, obviously, almost anyone can nakedly see what is superior about that offering.
Yeah, well, right? Nobody buys the monthly issues thinking that this is a time-sensitive thing. They buy it as a thing that I'm going to have, and it's going to be part of my collection. So why do comic books get treated that way? A Harry Potter novel isn't only out for a month, and then it's gone from stores, and if you didn't get it, you're shit out of luck. So of course you're going to be a trade waiter, because not everyone has the same entry point.
Nobody's going to put out one chapter of Harry Potter every month. And if you wait for the entire novel to be published, you have the finger pointed at you saying you're killing Harry Potter.
Hmm. Yeah. So it's ridiculous. And especially because a lot of the fans they get from crossover hits are people who want to just read the thing. They want to go in and buy it in chunks. And you think that they would have learned this from manga by now. Manga is published in the United States, not in a serialized format. It's published in collections that are numbered, that aren't afraid to have high numbers on them.
Well, I mean, manga is different in Japan and its country of origin in that the analog would be like, oh, I'm gonna buy the DC book this month, and the DC book will be 200 pages long, and it will have 15 different stories that are continuing, that maybe new ones are starting, maybe some are ending, but they're continuing stories that you're reading up on. And maybe some of them you don't like, but you're still going through and you're sampling. You're basically sampling a slice. You're subscribing to a slice of the stories as they go along. Why can't Marvel and DC do that?
It's a lot more less intimidating. One is you can sell the book with Batman, but then you can also get like a prez thing in there. And people are willing to try something because there's this thing that I don't recognize, but the entry point is I have to plunk down $3. And if I wait for the trade for this thing, which most of the fans will be, it's canceled by the time it comes out.
Well, and you have to add on to the fact that it's just, it's incredibly inconvenient to get comic books. There's one distributor, Diamond, who has a complete monopoly on the industry, and they don't make it easy for people to get these books. You have to go to specialty shops that may or may not be accommodating to you and hope that they even have that book in stock.
Does Diamond also exclusively distribute the trades? Like when they're at Barnes & Noble, are those distributed by Diamond, or are those distributed through other means?
I believe that they're distributed through other means. And I believe, at least in the case of Marvel and DC, their deals with, let's say, Barnes & Noble, that is a direct deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that at this point, you don't actually find most Marvel trades at Barnes & Noble.
Oh, because you get them there.
Can you?
Yeah, you still get them there.
I had heard that at one point that there was some kind of problem where they weren't selling books through Barnes & Noble because they didn't like the deal they were getting.
I the way I'm looking at Barnes & Noble and other bookstores is that almost without, we live in an age where it's hard to get print to sell. Comic books and manga are their one growth section. That I used to work at a Barnes & Noble, and I went back to the store I used to work at. The comic section is 3 times bigger than it was when I worked there. It's one of the places that continues to sell and grow. And there's DC stuff, there's Marvel stuff, there's a lot of Image stuff. It's way more accessible in that format, and more people are likely to go into a Barnes & Noble and than they would be to go into a comic shop, because most people don't even know the comic shop existed. I had a friend who was not a comics person, and I just asked him one day as a hypothetical, if you wanted to get a new DVD, what are all the places within like 10 minutes of here you could get it? And he just listed off everything, including like convenience stores. You can get big box stores like Target. You can get them everywhere. I mean, there's no question that if I really wanted to get The Shape of Water on Blu-ray when it came out on Blu-ray, I could find it easy. I wouldn't really have to hunt. I'd go to the mall, and there's probably at the mall a dozen stores where I could buy this on Blu-ray.
You want to watch a movie on a disc in the next hour, yeah. Go.
I can get it on iTunes if I really need to. There's really not hard for me to get this. And then I asked him, well, what if you want to get the latest issue of The Amazing Spider-Man? And he stopped. Because it's almost, what is this, like fucking Fight Club? I have to know the secret code to know where this shit is. But then even if you're a new comic book fan, you go into a comic book store and you're drowned in options. That you really, comic book store owners have to be way better at their jobs than almost anybody to be successful to those new people that come in, because you're just like, holy shit. And you just see just the image wall and there's all this stuff. And because comic books only advertise in comic books, you have never heard of any of these things.
The biggest market for new comic book readers, or, you know, you have a new comic book, you want to attract readers, your biggest market are people who already read comic books.
And it's a dwindling group. When there's stuff here, like the Flintstones, I have a lot of friends who don't regularly read comics that I could totally, they would fall in love with that. You know, movies, TV shows, even Netflix, they advertise in places that, it's like, imagine if the Netflix ads you saw for things were only on Netflix. You had to be logged into Netflix to see that ad at the top. That's crazy. That's crazy that anyone would ever think that that's sustainable, especially when these properties are the most popular they've ever been. And you don't even try. The New 52 was as short-term successful as it was, because it was this brief moment where they advertised outside of comic books. And it worked.
And the thing is that when you look outside of the realm of Marvel and DC at other smaller publishers, and I was actually reading about this recently. So one of the big popular indie books right now is The Wicked and the Divine by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. And it's published by Image. And they were talking about the economics of publishing a comic book. And they were saying, you know, when I publish a comic through Image, like kind of somewhere in the area of about 5,000 issues a month is kind of your break even. Like, we can kind of keep doing this in perpetuity.
God, if we 5,000, that's not much at all.
If we sell less than 5,000 copies, like, we can't afford to keep doing it. If you sell about, you know, 7,000 to 8,000 copies a month, like you're doing pretty well. Like you're making decent money. If you're selling 10,000 plus copies a month, 10,000, you're buying all your friends drinks because you're doing damn well for yourself.
Just insane.
The Image deal is way better than the Marvel deal. If you sell
10,000 copies at Marvel or DC,
yeah,
your ass is getting canceled immediately.
Yeah.
Like that is just trash garbage for Marvel and DC. And the thing is, like, we're talking about such tiny numbers, and you have more and more publishers that are looking into alternate formats. One of the series that I really love right now, it's called The Nameless City.
Oh, that's a great book.
And it only comes out in original graphic novels.
It's Faith Erin Hicks, right?
Faith Erin Hicks.
It's a great book.
It comes out about, I think, one original graphic novel comes about every year. She's done, I think the third one is going to be coming out this year. And it's in bookstores, yeah, like any other novel.
So is that what...
And how does that not make more sense than what is going on at Marvel and DC, where they're going broke, putting out numbers 5, 6, 10 times the amount that indie publishers are putting out, and indie publishers are making more money.
A lot more. There's a lot more people trying to get their piece of the pie at Marvel, including promotion and stuff. It's like those guys should lose their fucking jobs because they're not promoting outside of comics. But you know, there's all this stuff there with Image and stuff. Their books, I guarantee you, sell way better in the trade format than they do in even those monthly issues. And when you see even those diamond lists of those sales based on monthly issues versus graphic novel collections, the collections are such a different list than the ones that you see for monthly issues. It's night and day that when you see the list for the monthly issues, Batman, Amazing Spider-Man, whatever the big Marvel crossover is, Star Wars, those are always at the top. Then you look at the other list, and you look at it even for just the year, Watchmen always makes it on there. Sandman, there's like at the bottom of the 100, but those are consistent sellers.
The Walking Dead is usually pretty far up there.
Walking Dead always sells really well. Like the first three volumes of Walking Dead, Saga, Paper Girls, all of these books. There's a lot of Image on there. There's very few superheroes on that list. Superheroes just don't make that list. It's a different audience, and there has to be a recognition by the big two after other people make it and survive, of course, because they're not going to go in there fresh. But I think what we're waiting on is something like the Faith Erin Hicks Nameless City thing, where the first major Image book, like if Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, or if Fiona Staples and Brian K. Vaughan, or any of these guys, like if Jonathan Hickman did it, a big writer, Rick Remender, if any one of these guys said, you know what, the next book I put out from Image is going to be trade only. And the first time you see it, you're getting that first big chunk, and you might not see another one for 9 months to a year. I think one of them has to do that and survive. And I think once they do that, other people will do it. I think that it's what happened at Image in the first place, is that that's an explosion of Image that's been happening in the last 5 years. It came about because Walking Dead was this juggernaut for a long time that proved that you could have a massive hit on your hands that was creator owned. And then the next big hit of that was something like, say, Chew, which led to something like Saga, which led to Paper Girls. And suddenly there was a huge brain drain at both major companies where people wanted to tell stories that had nothing to do with Spider-Man. And they all jumped over and said, I have my story that I want to tell, and I want to control it, and I can do something crazy.
There was a time where you would have creators where they would go to an indie publisher like Image or Dark Horse, and they would do their prestige book that they really care about. And then they would go back to Marvel and DC, and they'd do a stint with one of them, and that's how they made their money. And now it's almost to the point where it's flip-flopped. You do your stint at Marvel or DC to get your name out there, and then you go to Image, and that's where you make your money, because you're getting paid for that book, because you own it.
And if I'm not mistaken, aren't there also now a host of other sort of, I wouldn't call them copycats because it's not necessarily something like that, but other labels, other imprints that are basically just creator-owned things on the same model as Image?
Yeah, you're seeing a lot more of them.
Like, isn't Wildstorm one of those as well?
No, Wildstorm is a DC imprint.
Oh, it's a DC.
But you've got Boom Studios.
Oni.
You've got Oni. I think you've still got Devil's Due. Or maybe they went out of business.
I think they became IDW, didn't they?
Yeah, but well, you've got IDW, certainly. You know, you have more and more of these guys who are, you know, printing small runs. Some of them are doing licensed work. Like, I mean, I would expect the Flintstones to come out of Dynamite or IDW.
Yeah.
IDW is making a lot of money off of Transformers and G.I. Joe right now.
Yeah.
But there are more and more of these small press studios that are putting out independent work.
And I think that as you get more and more of that stuff, I think that we're already seeing a lot of those creators, like with the Faith Erin Hicks Stainless City example, Raina Telgemeier. She is a creator that most comic book fans don't know the name of, but she sells way more than Batman, doing things like Smile and Sisters and Ghosts. And she just did an adaptation of some of the Babysitter's Club books.
Yeah.
Wow.
First Second Press has been putting out a lot of these young adult books that are selling millions of copies.
The real money these days is all in Scholastic.
Right.
And Scholastic, man, they're making some cheddar, man, because
Amulet, I think, is Scholastic. That thing was massive when it came out.
I think most of the Raina Telgemeier stuff comes out through Scholastic as well.
Probably.
Bone was re-released as a Scholastic book. Bone originally came out in the early 90s through like the late 90s, early 2000s. And it was an indie book that mostly people like me read. Mm-hmm. And it was a book where it was black and white. Most people didn't know about it. That was a weird time in my life. My two favorite comic books were Bone and Preacher. I had some variety in my diet. It's, you know.
I think at that time it was Usagi Yojimbo and Bone for me, which were both independent black and white comics.
So, yeah, I mean, this sort of existed. Bone had a life, and people did share it with their kids, and the letter column would have pictures of people sharing Bone with their kids. But then Bone made a deal with Scholastic, and they sent out these colored versions of it. They're beautifully colored, and they were re-released in Scholastic, and Bone became this massive fucking hit. And it was everywhere. Bone was massively popular and has never really slowed down since. And it had a whole new audience because now it was going directly to the audience it should have been aimed at all the time. Rather than, you know, monthly issues on Wednesday from a bunch of lifers like us, it was going directly to the kids that should have been reading it all. And what did that say? That kids weren't in that fucking shop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't count the number of times where I've gone to a friend of mine who has, I want to say, a 7 or 8 year old. And they're interested in comics. And they say, you know, what should I give to my kid? And the very first thing I do is I take a giant 1,300-page phone book that says Bone on the cover, and I said, give them this. And they're like, they're never going to read that. I'm like, give it to them. And I get it back a week later, and they've read it twice.
Yeah.
1,300 pages.
That's awesome.
Kids devour that shit. Comics are super popular now, and I think that they are getting bigger. But the problem is, I think our friend Sam Mulvey had said this too. He used the example, I think Gene Simmons said, there are no more rock stars. That there's nothing on TV like Cheers or The Cosby Show or... it hurts to say that. There's nothing on TV. I mean, the Super Bowl is the last rock star of television. It's the last thing that you get a bunch of people to watch all at once. That I have worked with people who are fans of media for a long time. And you think, what is the biggest show on television? And at any given time, even among people who watch a lot of TV and read a lot of books, no more than 10% of the people I knew were all watching that one show that was really popular. It's so spread out. There's a lot more there than there ever has been. So I think that when people look at the sales of Batman and say he's not selling a million copies anymore, though he should be able to because he's more popular than he's ever been, there's more comics that are being sold. It's just not just the monopoly of these two companies.
Yeah. When we talk about the fragility of the comic industry, we're talking about DC and Marvel. Because if you look outside of those two companies, it doesn't exist. Because you have a whole plethora of companies that are looking at other revenue streams. They're looking at other business models. And comic books as a medium is robust. Comic books have existed for a very long time, and I think that they're only going to continue to exist. But when we talk about who the big players are in that industry, it's not necessarily going to be in Marvel and DC.
The medium is great. You know, I think the industry is weak.
At this point, Marvel and DC are basically being propped up by the companies that own them on the basis of being IP farms that they can make successful media properties out of. And at a certain point, people's appetite for superheroes is going to crest.
Yeah.
It has to happen eventually, whether it's now or 10 years from now.
We don't live in a world where Westerns are every movie anymore.
Right. And at that point, Marvel and DC could, you know, if not go away, then become much smaller than they have been in decades. But comic books will continue.
I think it's a real question of, there's a definite, again, that climate change analogy, that things are different. And it's a question of how they're going to adapt to that difference and how much they're going to hurt before they make that change. And I think they're so bought into this formula of, I sell this as disposable magazines, even though that hasn't been the way people have consumed our stuff for a very long time.
And they're not selling them at a disposable price.
No, they're selling them as if they're books. I mean, they're too expensive.
I have a coworker who still, he exclusively buys floppies. Mm-hmm. He buys them, he reads them, and then he gives them away. And every time he goes to the comic book store, which is usually every other week or every 3 weeks, and he usually drops between about $80 and $120.
Damn.
Yeah. It's expensive habit.
And he is exactly the customer that Marvel and DC exist on the basis of. He is keeping those businesses afloat.
He's the whale, right?
Right? Yeah. He's the guy, you know, he's double income, no kids, you know, him and his wife. And he is, you know, he has his box. He probably has 15 titles that he's subscribed to that they know to order for him every month, plus extra things that he just randomly grabs. And he's in the financial position to do that. And I'm sure that they love him for that. But there are only so many people like him out there.
I mean,
they're not making new ones.
At the height of my fandom with that, and there's a certain ritual in going on Wednesdays that I miss, but I don't miss how much it cost for a thing that I'm just going to buy the trade for anyways.
Right.
And if they're going to make it in a format that I prefer, they shouldn't get angry that I choose that format over the one that they prefer.
Right. And I'm honestly, probably
they still make the trade format.
Yeah,
right. It's not like they're threatening to take it away because they won't make as much money. They're still making money off
right,
of you.
And that's why they won't stop doing it, even if they'll bitch to high heaven and tell you you're killing the comics industry by buying their product in a format that they offer. So they're obviously making money off of
it. But they want me to buy it twice.
But I honestly, I probably spend almost as much money on comic books as he does. But I'm a trade waiter. I buy probably 4 or 5 trades a month at $15 to $20 a pop, depending on what kind of quality they are and who's selling it. But those go on my bookshelf.
Yeah.
Not in a long box that goes in my closet that if I want to share that with somebody, I have to grab a fistful of polybagged individual issues that you have to open each one and very carefully read it so you don't crumple it. It's like, no. It's a book. It goes on the bookshelf. If it gets damaged, I buy a new one, and I don't have to worry about combing through back issue bins to find it.
Mm-hmm.
I think people get so married to the tradition of this is how this thing is organized, this is how this thing is put out, that they're afraid to change it. And the thing is, it has changed, and they need to accept that and change it. Maybe the floppy is going to be a thing that doesn't exist anymore. What if the monthly issues...
I pray for that day.
I really do. I think that would be the best thing they could do. The comic book shops would still exist in the same way that all specialty shops exist. Not as the sole place to buy a thing, but as the place to buy the thing where you can get more of it and you can get a deeper cut into the stuff that you want. And you have more informed people that work there who will help you find even new stuff.
I mean, in this day and age, you never have to set foot in a record store, and yet record stores still exist.
Yeah, I really think that comic books have to become a thing where we just have to retire this notion that they're magazines. They haven't been magazines to be. Even the people who bought the magazines didn't treat them like magazines. Like, I don't hold on to every issue of, you know, Time that I buy, unless I'm a creepy shut-in hoarder. but the expectation that I have to do that plus buy the collections, because again, that long box is so unwieldy that I have to buy the shelf one so that I can read it again.
Yep.
I mean, that's insane that anyone would ever expect that of me ever.
Well, and it's like they're expecting you to buy a TV series on DVD one disc at a time. Like, one disc is one episode. You have to buy it every week, and it's got ads on there forever that you have to sit through every time you watch it, whether it's today or 10 years from now.
Oh, don't give them ideas.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine?
Oh, God. be a nightmare. But yeah, I could. It's crazy.
The more you dig into it, the more ridiculous it seems.
We don't live in the same world that we did in 1938 when they started selling these things as magazines, when they were considered disposable.
Before 38, even.
And even before that, they were also cheap back then. Yeah. And they're not cheap anymore. They know that their primary audience is collectors, and they have been selling more and more to the collector market to the point that they shut out new readers. I don't know what the comic book industry will look like in 20 years if they don't change this. I want this industry to survive me. I want this format. I don't care about the Marvel and DC as companies. I care about this medium. That the only thing that I want to keep Marvel and DC alive for is to keep the back catalog alive so people can read it. Not because I have any sort of corporate, you know, loyalty to them. If nothing else, my loyalty, the older I get, is more towards creators. I want to see what they do. I want them to make money off of it. I want the people who make comics now to not be as poor as Steve Ditko is, who created Spider-Man, who has literally made that company billions of dollars, yet he lives on very, very limited means. That's not right. It's not right that that's the way that that used to be. I mean, there was actually an interview I saw with Todd McFarlane, you know, the creator of Spawn, and drew a bunch of comics, and he referenced Kurt Swan. Kurt Swan was an artist who drew Superman from the 50s to the mid-80s. The vision of Superman in a comic book that you have is Kurt Swan a lot of the time. That this is a guy who drew this character for 30 years, and one day they just decided that nobody wanted to buy Kurt Swan anymore, so they stopped giving him work. And he doesn't own any of the stuff that he drew. He doesn't control it. He can't continue to draw Superman stories to find out if there's still a market for it. They just decided that he was out of style one day, and suddenly he had to find a way to make a living. And Todd McFarlane said, I'm never going to have that happen to me, because that's not right.
Yeah. And yeah, you hear stories like Bill Mantlow all the time, creator of Rocket Raccoon, who he was hit by a car and got pretty severe brain damage, I believe in the 80s, and had been basically like limping along on whatever money his family had for many, many years, just barely scraping by, not getting the care that he needs, until they put Guardians of the Galaxy out, which had a character that he created, Rocket Raccoon, and thankfully he had a deal in place with Marvel, I believe, that gave him some kind of credit and some kind of royalty for that character, such that when that movie was a huge success, he could actually get taken care of. But, you know, how many creators are there out there who do not have that kind of arrangement, who do not have a marketable character that's going to be put in this giant popular movie franchise?
Yeah, it's wrong. The fact that something like the Hero Initiative, which is a charity to help comic book creators who can't make their basic payments on things like, say, healthcare or rent, the fact that that...
It's insane to me that the externalities of a huge company, of comic book companies, the externality is, like, just having all of your workforce just, like, be decrepit and not compensated.
The fact that
it's crazy.
It's crazy.
We need a charity to help take care of the people that they throw away.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. We're back to that pile of rocks given to the Neanderthal again, yes. Where it just feels like, what's this for? Well,
let's just put it this way. We can do better. We can clearly do better.
And I think the image model is better, because you used to have to sell something like $100,000 to be able to buy everyone drinks. But the fact that something like Saga can exist, and creators don't have to basically eat editorial shit all the time and do whatever it is that their bosses say so that they can continue to be so gracious that they're allowed to make a living at this, and then they can own their own destiny. And, you know, something like, you know, Sex Criminals or Bitch Planet or Saga or any of these books would never be allowed to exist, even at Vertigo. They would never. And now you can actually go, no, I will prove that people want what I'm selling.
Sure.
And I like that that exists that way. I mean, Marvel or DC were never going to publish The Nameless City. They were never going to publish Smile. But I like that there's a place out there that is, because what it does is immediately prove them wrong, that not everything has to have Batman in it to sell. Ah. And I just wish that the industry would kind of get, it's time to kill the floppy.
Kill the floppy.
Kill it dead.
I know. We just have to have that one success case. Kill that motherfucker.
Radio versus the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Valverde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music was written and performed by Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobias Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Dan Lombardo. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
I had started talking to Todd McFarlane about Haunt, and he was kind of the last guy that I got to know really well. You know, I get to hang out with him a bunch, and he was kind of lamenting one day about, these artists and writers these days, you know, they just don't value themselves enough. You know, it's something that really sticks in his craw, and it's something I really admire about him, because, you know, he's always supportive of creators and artists, and you know, really wants them to invest in themselves. And, you know, he's kind of sitting there, he's like, these guys, you know, they build their names at Image, and they do all these books for themselves, and then, you know, Marvel comes calling, and then they're off, you know, and they're off, you know.
He doesn't understand that. He can't understand how.
I mean, I can't understand it, you know, because it's like you're basically at Image, you're basically the owner of a restaurant. And then, you know, Steak and Shake calls or Red Lobster calls, and you're like,
that's the Kentucky guy.
That's such
a Kentucky the Steak and Shake. Well done.
Sorry. I changed it to Red Lobster at the last minute. but like to be the owner of your own restaurant and have Red Lobster call and be like, hey, you want to come cook some fish for us? And be like, oh my God, finally I'm getting called to the big leagues. I get to be at the grill at a Red Lobster. And it's like, you owned your own restaurant. You were building your own empire. Like, what are you doing?